Live from our nation's capital.
President Joe Biden's $1.9 trillion pandemic relief package.
We're not going to hear any more about Operation Warp Speed. They're going to be calling it the COVID response.
We're talking right now about 2024 jockeying amongst Republicans.
Bloomberg, sound off. The insiders, the influencers, the insights.
Biden has promised again and again that he will unite the country.
Who do you think Biden has to watch in terms of moderate defectors?
The House has been voting for this stimulus package basically for months.
This is Bloomberg Sound On with Kevin Cirilli on Bloomberg Radio.
A behind-the-scenes look at President Biden's inauguration. Plus, what are his first steps now that he is President of the United States? Can he unify the country, or is it just political wishful thinking? Congresswoman Carolyn Maloney joins me, and the Bloomberg Politics team just got back from the Capitol, where we were covering President Biden's inauguration. And that, of course, is where we begin today with President Biden's inaugural address, in which he said that democracy has prevailed just more than a week after the attack on the Capitol. Here's sound on that.
This is America's day. This is democracy's day. The will of the people has been heard, and the will of the people has been heeded. We've learned again that democracy is precious. Democracy is fragile. And at this hour, my friends, democracy has prevailed.
It was an historic day. This, as Vice President Kamala Harris became the first female vice president, as well as the first African-American vice president and Asian vice president of Asian descent, shattering glass ceilings for the number two in this administration. We've got sound on what Biden went on to say about the insurrectionists not achieving their goal to delay democracy. Roll the tape.
Here we stand, just days after a riotous mob thought they could use violence to silence the will of the people, to stop the work of our democracy, to drive us from this sacred ground. It did not happen. It will never happen. Not today, not tomorrow, not ever. Not ever.
The newly sworn-in president sought to unify the country, and he was speaking to a small crowd of several hundred of top administration officials in his new administration, as well as lawmakers from all sides of the aisle, including the now former Vice President Mike Pence, who sat just feet away from him on the risers outside of the Capitol, as well as Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell. He called for a change in tone. And it was really an ethos pitch to try to re-heal the country that he says has gone too far into partisan politics. Here he is.
The answer is not to turn inward, to retreat into competing factions. We must end this uncivil war that pits red against blue, rural versus urban, conservative versus liberal. We can do this.
We're going to talk all about the policy prescriptions of the Biden administration. We're also going to check in with Congresswoman Carolyn Maloney. But we begin tonight with immediate analysis from the Bloomberg Politics team, Jeannie Sean Zeno, Iona College professor, and as well as Rick Davis, a partner at Stonecourt Capital, former campaign manager for John McCain's 2008 presidential campaign. Jeannie, I'll start with you. I mean, you know, I was there, I was watching it, and I'll scatter my observations throughout the hour and what we observed and whatnot. But it really was an ethos pitch rooted in prayer. At one point, a moment of silence for the 400,000 Americans who have lost their lives to COVID-19. And really, a poignant moment and a pitch to heal the country, Jeannie Zeno.
It was in some ways something you might hear on the pulpit. And, you know, Joe Biden, not necessarily known for his, you know, oratory skills, but I thought he delivered the speech very well. And it did have a sense, as you're saying, of a moment of silence, as he called for, of prayer. And you were there. I was in New York, but you were there. And the pictures that we were seeing on TV, at least, of those flags, incredibly dramatic, representing those 400,000 people. So I I do agree. It had that sense. He also vowed. I was struck by the not surprised, but struck by how different his approach was to President Trump, who's constantly playing to his base. Here was Joe Biden talking about being the president for all the people and saying, give me a chance, essentially, to the 70 million people who voted for his opponent. So it was, you know, just a stark contrast to what I think we're used to now after these 4 years.
I was struck by one moment when Vice President Kamala Harris walked out of the entrance to the Capitol Dome, and she, as she walked out with her husband, Doug, and she paused and she, you know, nodded to President, former President Obama, as well as the former First Lady Michelle Obama, Rick Davis. But then she glanced forward, and it only happened in about a half a second. But being there to capture this, she glanced forward and she did a nod to Hillary Clinton, who was seated adjacent behind the Obamas. And it was a wink and a clear nod of a glass ceiling that had been shattered, Rick Davis.
Yeah, we remember the message that Hillary Clinton took into the general election. It was time to, you know, break that glass ceiling, and the millions of shards of glass come tumbling down. She was close. It only took 4 years later for part of that ceiling to cave in under the weight of the election victory of this team. So, you know, it had to be a special moment for her. We talked about earlier today the weight of history being on her now, you know, that she's now much more of a symbolism to young women and minorities around the world about having the ability to achieve greatness in your own lifetime. And that's a special moment. And I'm sure she shared that moment internally with the former First Lady and candidate for president, Hillary
Clinton. This was such a subdued event. And you both know, I mean, whenever we cover State of the Unions, and even to some extent the debates, but State of the Union address, it's everyone in one room. And it's almost overwhelming. It's like the Oscars, for lack of a better word, of politics. But this was much more subdued because there was really no audience except political types, and only several hundred of them. And where President Biden spoke, he would typically be looking out at the National Mall, which is several football fields length. And typically there would be tens of thousands, or if not hundreds of thousands, of supporters and Americans there to support the peaceful transition of power. All of that was thrown out the window. Instead, where he stood on the podium, overlooking the reflection pool, the Washington Monument, and then in the far end of the National Mall, the Lincoln Memorial, and even beyond the bridge in Arlington, the Arlington National Cemetery, were flags. And flags for the 400,000 Americans who had lost their lives. It was incredibly moving, Jeannie, as you mentioned this. But it also was a return to a previous tone that many of his peers are familiar with. And that was really what I was thinking when I was covering this today, Jeannie, was he was speaking on a platform of peers, having served. He's one of them. He, having served in Congress for several decades, Leader McConnell, with whom he went to St. Matthew's Cathedral earlier in the day to kickstart the day, as well as with Speaker Pelosi, they came up together, and it was a remarkable, remarkable contrast in tones. Regardless of which one feels is the better tone, it was very different in terms of the approach that we are going to be getting from the Biden administration, Jeannie Zeno.
And I think that may be why when Lady Gaga walked out with her skirt, we all said, oh, and I know we'll talk about that less important stuff later, yeah, although I did really, really appreciate the
entertainment. For the record, Christine Barbata, who's our executive producer, I did not start off with Gaga, and I got several minutes in before she came up, but go ahead,
I'm sorry, Christine.
And by the way,
Garth Brooks, he killed it. They were amazing, but to your point, it did seem to a certain extent, and I am curious to hear from my students, for instance, some of whom are as young as 18, 19 years old, what they think of this, because of course for their young lives President Trump has been in for 4 years, so this sort of return to normalcy, as you're talking about, which is common to us and many of the people on that stage, is something that they're not used to. And so I am curious to see how they respond to that, this real effort on the part of Biden and his team to appeal across the aisle, to have a sense of respect for people with different opinions, to, as we were just talking about, reach over and not just reach back to the base. These are all things that we're not used to. And for young people, it's been a little bit of time since they haven't had this in their young lives. So I am curious to see how they respond to that. And I think that is what Biden is going to do. And I'm curious about how it's going to play, particularly with the media.
Well, when Senator Roy Blunt, Rick Davis, was speaking, and he was the chairman of the inauguration committee, he was really the point person in the Senate who oversaw all of the events. He's a Republican from Missouri. I was really struck by just how he spoke so frequently at this inaugural event. But I couldn't help but think, where is President Trump? And there was a moment, and I'll take folks behind the scenes, and coming back, we'll get Rick to weigh in on this. But there was a moment where the president's prepared remarks were in a giant teleprompter screen, as is typical. So he's looking probably, I would say, 50 feet ahead of him at this giant teleprompter, square black screen with white letterings on it scrolling, as is tradition. And seated behind him were former presidents Obama, Bush, and Clinton. Obviously, now former President Trump was not there. But the prepared text in which he thanks the former presidents, he was to mention them name by name by name. But he ad-libbed a change as it came up. And I couldn't help but think that he did that because he didn't want to make that speech about Trump. And he knew that if he were to say those three names, that it would have been, well, where's President Trump? But there was Vice President Pence, now former Vice President Pence, and Trump was nowhere to be found. Breaking news, Biden signs actions on Paris Climate Accord and mask wearing. We'll get into that coming up next. Policy. This is Bloomberg.
This is Bloomberg Sound On with Kevin Cirilli on Bloomberg Radio.
Breaking news, President Joe Biden has signed some executive orders, and I'm awaiting some sound on that, actually. And as soon as I get it, I'll play the tape for you. At the White House, the president signing an executive order, executive action on the Paris Climate Accord, as well as a mask-wearing mandate on federal grounds. We've also got some new details on that scoop from my colleague Jennifer Jacobs, who noted that former President Trump wrote a letter to President Biden, as is a tradition, and left it on his desk. Biden says, and we'll hear this in the tape, that it was a, quote, very generous letter, end quote, to him. So there you have it. Let's talk about some of these policies with the Bloomberg Politics team, Jeannie Shanzano and Rick Davis. All right, Rick Davis, he's rejoining the Paris Climate Accords and signing a federally mask-wearing mandate. He signed it, what I'm told, is made some very brief remarks, with the audio a little difficult to hear. But what does it mean in terms of the policy for the Paris Climate Accords, Rick Davis?
Well, I think it sets a message to the world. It doesn't really change much of what we're doing domestically related to the climate. He'll tackle that through legislation on various issues that he's got planned and announced. But it does send a message to the world that we're back to reengaging. We want to retake our leadership position on issues related to climate by being in the Paris Accords.
Let's toss back into that tape. I hear we corrected the audio. Here he is.
Here is... relates to COVID, and it's requiring, as I said all along, where I have authority, mandating masks be worn, social distancing be kept on federal property and interstate commerce, etc. So this is the first one I'm signing. And the second one I'm signing here is the support for underserved communities, and we're going to already going to make sure we have some bedrock equity, equality as it relates to how we treat people and healthcare and other things. We'll give you copies of these executive orders. And the third one I'm going to sign, and that's what I'm going to do while you're all here, is the commitment I made that we're going to rejoin the Paris Climate Accord as of today.
Mr. President, please go.
The president wrote a very generous letter. I have it's because it was private. I will not talk about it until I talk to him. But it was generous.
To Brazil on climate change. You were rejoining Paris Agreement. And you mentioned
Brazil. You guys, come on, let's go.
Do you have concerns about
it? Let's go, you guys. Press, let's go.
Welcome to the White House. Do you have any concerns?
You guys, let's go, you guys.
All right, you were listening there to brief remarks made by President Joe Biden, a very different tone than what the press pool is used to, clearly. Bloomberg Politics team, Jeannie Shanzano and Rick Davis. I mean, Rick, I'm going to let you finish your thought. I feel like we've been in and out with you as we awaited that playback, but very clearly a different tone.
Yeah, different tone. Very straightforward. No real hyperbole, as Donald Trump liked to call it. I would say that the second proclamation that he signed deals with a tasking order to the OMB, Office of Management and Budget in the White House, to be more equitably allocating federal resources to communities that are underserved and in the minority community. And that actually has real practical impact, right? I mean, some of these things will be symbolic, like joining the Paris Peace Accords again or Climate Accords. But this one actually will have OMB relook at how they allocate federal resources across the board. Billions of dollars will be affected by this if they do a good job at it, and could really make a difference in communities of color and underserved communities all around the country, many of which were ignored by the Trump administration.
You know, and just the – and I know we're on radio, so I do want to set the scene a little bit where President Biden was seated behind the desk in the Oval Office, and already the changing of the furniture and the images and the photographs on the table behind him. And there was a picture of his son, Bo Biden, who passed away on his shoulders from when he was a boy, and President Biden looking significantly younger as the dad. There was also a picture of him and his wife, Dr. Jill Biden. The president spoke with a mask on his face. I mean, it's a new era, Jeannie Shanzano, and even with these signings of these executive orders, clearly showing whether it's, as Rick just pointed out, it's a clear difference in terms of the policies.
It is a difference, and in both the look of it, as you were just explaining, and also what he is doing, pulling back on so much of what the Trump administration did. And a couple things about this executive order signing, this series that he's signing today, as many we're hearing as 12 to 17, that's striking, is that this is now the way we make policy in the United States. And it is really, really a shocking development in the modern era that when Congress isn't acting, you have presidents coming in and via executive action making these types of steps. And so that, number one, is worth noting. And number two, the fact that Joe Biden is doing so many in the first day and not spreading them out over time so that the media and the public can digest better each one of these, in part because they're very different. You have the environmental climate ones, racial justice, immigration, COVID, public health. You have student loan deferment. These are all big actions he is taking, and he's doing them in this concentrated fashion, I think, is also worth noting.
Can I ask you, Rick Davis, is that because Americans have expected more to come from the executive branch over the past decade plus years? Is that just an evolution of what we think a president should do after a very multi-billion dollar presidential fight campaign on day one?
You know, I have a slightly different perspective. I honestly don't think people are hotly anticipating what the top 12, you know, executive orders are coming out.
Come on, I'm a nerd, Rick.
in fact, it kind of steps on the message, right? I mean, like, it, just as someone who's orchestrated these kinds of events in the past, you just spent all this time, 20 minutes on national TV globally, sending out a message of unity and really the optics were fantastic. I mean, and then you sort of make it policy right away, right? I mean, like before the day is out, we're going to get in there and sit down at the Resolute desk and start signing executive orders. I mean, some of which are just extensions of things that already exist, but you want to take the high ground on it, right? You want to show everybody you're doing something. And I think people will judge a president over time, not in the first 24 hours. And I do think sometimes the advisors, you know, the staff want to make more of the first few hours in office than really the American public desires. They want you to do the right thing. They don't want you to do everything in the first 24 hours.
You know, and really, I hear you on that point, and it's just remarkable. And I remember covering the Obama years and just seeing the executive orders and the fight that he had with Congress. But let's bring up Congress, because quite honestly, Rick, I mean, he had to sign these executive orders in order to bypass Congress, and he's staring down a fight of $1.9 trillion. And oh, yeah, the Senate is going to have an impeachment trial.
Yeah, and I think this just makes it a little bit harder, frankly. I mean, part of the message we learned on January 6th was that these are separate and equally powerful sections of the government, the legislative branch and the presidency. And Trump blurred the lines. I mean, he basically treated Congress as if it were a staff operation. And what we learned is you can't get away with that
just,
over time.
I'm just holding on to that. That was genius. He treated Congress like a staff operation. It's really good. Okay, go ahead, Rick. Sorry.
No,
that
bear, okay.
That bore
anything
repeating.
Anything that entertains you makes me happy.
Haven't I been entertained enough covering the Trump White House? Go ahead.
Yeah, you need some time off.
Yep.
And so the reality to this is that his message of unity, his message of let's work together, needs to match sort of the conduct he has in office. So you want to show everybody you're in action. You want to show everybody that you're not wasting any time. You've made a lot of promises in a campaign. You want to keep them, but you want to do it in a way that sort of builds comedy amongst the Congress, too. And I don't think they care about this stuff. I mean, it's things that he can do as president. I don't think they feel like they're being usurped on Capitol Hill. But if it becomes a habit, I think they'll raise some objections.
Let's talk about specifically the balancing act, Jeannie, about the impeachment trial as well as the $1.9 trillion stimulus chatter. Because we all know that when there's an impeachment trial on the news, that is going to dominate all of the oxygen in the room. Is that really the emphasis that a new administration wants to put instead of on a concrete action like a $1.9 trillion? I say this knowing full well that Republicans like Leader McConnell would like to see there to be some accountability. You know, I go off of the remarks that he made yesterday. But they also know that, okay, the Republicans aren't necessarily behind $1.9 trillion. Am I making sense, Jeannie?
You always make sense, Kevin Cirilli, and you've made sense there. Absolutely, to answer your first question, this is not what any administration wants to walk into. You do not want your predecessor taking up all the oxygen in the room and having what's going to surely turn out to be a partisan fight. Let's not forget, 70 million Americans voted for Donald Trump. People may not like what he did in terms of the insurrection on the Capitol, certainly, but look at the polls coming out of the Republican Party, and that'll tell you what is going to happen when this trial is held. You have 6 or 7 out of 10 Republicans saying the election was stolen. And so to put this man, after he's left office, on trial in the Senate, it's going to be a partisan battle. So you put that there, then you add to that the incoming president, the new president, Joe Biden, has a immigration bill, which has a pathway towards citizenship, we understand, for 11 million undocumented. We all know how long they've been trying to pass that. And you add to that then an almost $2 trillion stimulus bill, mm-hmm, that we've already heard moderate Republicans in the Senate say, you know, we don't have to push this. You know, Rick and I talked today to a representative, certainly in the House, who said, you know, he's got a lot of questions. We acted last year. Do we have to do this again right now? So you couple those and then talk about things like, oh, infrastructure. And that'll tell you how much Biden wants to talk about Donald Trump and his trial in the Senate.
Yeah.
It's going to be tough, and it's a 50-50 Senate, let's not forget. This is the thinnest margin the Democrats could have.
Fascinating. My name is Kevin Cerulli. I'm the chief Washington correspondent for Bloomberg Television and for Bloomberg Radio, joined by the esteemed team of Bloomberg Politics contributors, Jeannie Shawn Zeno, as well as Rick Davis. And Rick, you mentioned that I need a vacation. I'm going on vacation for 2 weeks, my first one ever. And I'm taking it, and I'm so grateful that you two are going to be holding down the fort for me. Well, I, you know, take a breather after the six-year run that I spent covering Donald Trump. But, you know, text me. I would love to hear how things are going. But don't forget about me, all right, Rick?
Don't worry. We won't forget about you. And we look forward to hearing about what it's like to be in quarantine for 2 weeks.
Jeannie, I'm going to read Jeannie's book. And that I can promise you. It's literally on my to-do list. And her new book. Jeannie, plug your book.
Oh, my new book. I'm just so on your vacation. I'm jealous.
That's what I do is I read. American Democracy in Crisis. That's going to be my reading. American Democracy in Crisis. Let's take a listen to some sound on this from Senator Amy Klobuchar. It fits with your book. See, Jeannie, that was my pivot.
That was brilliant.
She was talking about whether or not we as a nation have become too jaded. Let's roll the tape. Here's sound from Senator Amy Klobuchar from the inauguration.
Have we become too jaded, too accustomed to the ritual of the passing of the torch of democracy to truly appreciate what a blessing and a privilege it is to witness this moment? I think not.
And even as she said that, it was just hours after President Trump departed from the White House to join Pace Andrews and then flew to Mar-a-Lago in Florida. And before he departed, he again bucked tradition and made some comments. And he said, well, let's roll the tape. I've got sound on it. Here's the former president of the United States, his last comments before taking off to Mar-a-Lago.
I wish the new administration great luck and great success. I think they'll have great success. They have the foundation to do something really spectacular. So just a goodbye. We love you. We will be back in some form. Have a good life. We will see you soon.
Have a good life. We'll see you soon. Rick Davis, the Republican Party has a lot of, well, what does the Republican Party have to do at the start of a new cycle, Rick Davis?
Well, I think they have to define what they're going to be for this year, right? They don't have Donald Trump telling them what to do. So they're actually going to have a moment to look in and say, what are our priorities? Mitch McConnell actually gets to set the agenda within the Republicans in the Senate, and Kevin McCarthy is going to sit down with his caucus, which probably will be more problematic because of all the concerns that we have with the Republican caucus and their role in the January 6th attack on the Capitol, and talk about what their priorities are. Will they be obstructionists? Will they be cooperating? Were they going to try and get the best deal they can in a Congress that's led by Democrats? These are the things they're going to do, practically speaking. But they're all looking back at their home states and going, oh, my God, the politics is horrible for me right now. How am I going to make this better before the 2022 midterm elections?
And even as we say that, and we're awaiting Congresswoman Carolyn Maloney, a Democrat from New York, to call us in. So, Jeannie, if I interrupt you, it's because we got the congresswoman on the line and I want to make sure that we all get to ask her some of our questions. But I was struck. I still can't get over the dynamic between President Trump and Mike Pence. And I was observing him when he was on the risers of the inauguration today with his wife, Karen. And they weren't, you know, away from everyone, but it was, you definitely felt that they weren't on the in, so to speak, with all of the other former presidents. And then at one point, Jeannie, Hillary Clinton walked over to now former Vice President Pence and Karen, and they shared a brief exchange. And I just thought, if I had a microphone, I would just put it right there to hear what they were talking about. Donna Brazile was talking to them, but Donna Brazile actually had a longer conversation with Mike Pence. She, of course, the former Democratic, top Democrat in terms of the party officials. So I mean, where does Mike Pence go from here, Jeannie Zeno?
Mike Pence has had a really, really challenging couple weeks. And yeah. I think, you know, he's
got, he needs a vacation.
He needs that vacation that you're taking, Kevin. I thought it was really, really stunning to see him sitting there, as you mentioned, seems sort of on his own, sort of isolated in the way we keep hearing that Donald Trump has been. I do think, as Rick was just mentioning, people looking towards 2022, he, of course, is looking towards 2024. And so he's got to think really, really carefully about how he maps that out. And we see the Republican Party starting to do that already. And I hate to talk about the next election, the day of the inauguration, but that's literally what's going on. We've got Kamala Harris, who likely will be the nominee on the Democratic side, assuming Joe Biden doesn't run. And then you've got a host of Republicans from Marco Rubio and, of course, the former Vice President Pence and so many others, Josh Hawley and so many others who want to put their name in. So they're already jockeying for position there. And Mike Pence surely has a prominent place in that pack. And the question is, does he hug tight to Trump given this breach, or does he move away?
Really, really great point. I want to welcome now to the program Congresswoman Carolyn Maloney. She's a Democrat from New York. Congresswoman, I didn't see you up there at the inauguration. Did you get a Gaga selfie?
Oh, yes, I did. I was right up there on the left-hand side on the podium, and it was so exciting beyond words to see a Democratic president who's such a fine person and the new first lady and then the first woman vice president in history sworn in as our president and vice president.
All right. I mean, yeah, it really
and inspiring.
It really was. I mean, it was a especially given what happened at the Capitol just more than a week ago. I thought this is how I want to remember the Capitol. And for you as a congresswoman, having been there during that attack, I mean, what did just put in perspective for us just the significance that this inauguration even happened, where 25,000 troops descended upon Washington, D.C.?
Well, it was on everybody's mind.
Yep.
Everyone was talking about it. And it was a stark difference. In the first attack, we were not prepared. The police were overwhelmed. We didn't have enough people there. They didn't expect this amount of force coming at them. This time, we were sort of over-prepared. They had a fence around, an unscalable fence around the Capitol, and then a fence around the fence. And in the Capitol, walking through it, it was sort of sad, because you saw barracks everywhere and cots, because the National Guard had turned the grounds of the Capitol. They put up tents for their housing, and many were sleeping in the Capitol itself. So coming into Washington, it looked more like it was eerie. No cars on the street, people not on the street, and everywhere you looked, you saw military personnel. It almost looked like a military camp more than the capital of our country.
That's a great way to put it, and that is exactly what I thought. Because, and I was really struck by that. I didn't recognize some of the neighborhoods on my way into the compound and onto the campus because of the presence. And I can't overstate this enough how transformed this city has been as a result of that. I do want to ask you about policy. I know you're pressed for time, so let me ask you specifically: can Congress deal with a $1.9 trillion stimulus plan while the Senate is having the impeachment trial? Is that a political risk for the new administration?
I think we can do both at the same time. We have to get the resources out across the country to help this country recover from COVID. We're in a fight or a race against the virus. We have to get vaccines out. In New York, we've absolutely used up all our vaccines. We need more resources coming to help the medical establishment and to help the people. And we've got to do it. I think that Democrats and Republicans will be united in responding to the needs of the country, of getting another COVID package out there, and most importantly, the dollars for the vaccines so that people can recover. We're not. Our economy is not going to recover until this vaccine is under control. And the only way we're going to get it under control is to get more people vaccinated. If the vaccine is infecting more and more people, then you'll see more variants coming out, and the mutations are more deadly than the first round of COVID. It's far more contagious, as we've seen from South Africa and England. So we want to stop it, and the only way we can stop it is with vaccinations, getting our people protected. And we won't be able to open up our businesses and our restaurants and our stores and the vitality of our great country until we control this disease. So I think there'll be a lot of enthusiasm on both sides of the aisle. You've got to realize that President Biden grew up in the House and the Senate. He knows everybody. He has a history of working across the aisle. The theme of his speech was unity, unity and hope and working together. Many are saying it's the best speech since John Fitzgerald Kennedy's. It was inspiring, and it was unifying. It was hopeful. It was bold. It was really powerful.
Representative Maloney, sorry, this is Jeannie Zeno. I wanted to just ask, so good to talk to you. I am a New Yorker, so I'm a neighboring constituent. I wanted to just get back to the historic nature of the day and noting that you had just signed, the bill was signed for the first VA hospital to be named after a woman veteran in our area, and I think across the country, if I'm not mistaken. But
first in history, my friend. First in history, Jeannie.
Fascinating. And of course, today with Kamala Harris, can you just talk a little bit, I think about all my students, for what this means to think that 2020, we finally have the first female vice president of the United States?
Well, 2020, as you know, is the 100th anniversary of women gaining the right to vote. It's a historically important, it's a great milestone. Our founding mother said from the vote would come all other power. Well, it hasn't worked out that way. Many women have experienced tremendous amount of discrimination in their life. And quite frankly, and to be honest with you, I never thought that I would see a female vice president. I really didn't. I literally started crying. And you saw New York's Associate Justice Sonia Sotomayor, the first Latina woman doing the honor of swearing her into office. That was moving, too, to see the women on the Supreme Court, to see so many important women like Hillary Clinton and Nancy Pelosi and all the women members of Congress and the senators that have been elected. And I think that it is a tremendous message to young girls and boys and women across this country that you can do anything, that the sky's the limit. You can be the vice president. And that's not how most women were raised. And most women have experienced throughout their life tremendous discrimination. So I think that she is really going to lift up the hopes and dreams of women and girls across the country, probably across the world. And she's such a nice person, an accomplished person. And I really think we have a team of very inclusive people who want to work together. But we're always better when we work together.
Congresswoman
Maloney.
No one
can beat the U.S. without the unity and hope we have for tomorrow. Thank you.
I love the unity message, and it's really punched through today. This is Rick Davis from Washington, and thank you for joining the show. And I wanted to go back to your earlier comments about the January 6th situation and how it was on everybody's mind today. And I'm kind of curious, as chairwoman of the House Committee on Oversight and Reform, a big investigative committee and in the House of Representatives with subpoena power, are you involved in any of the investigation as to what happened inside the Capitol that day, why we got to where we were? And if so, maybe shed some light on what you think the timing of information is, because obviously information coming out of that investigation would be, I think, very germane to the debate that'll be going on in the Senate on impeachment.
Well, we've called for two investigations that we're deeply involved in. One is with the FBI and the federal agencies that were involved in preparing for January 6th. Why were they so ill prepared? There were reports in the paper about violence on the internet and of a storming of the Capitol. It was like being reported. Yet clearly we were not prepared. So we've asked for documents, briefings, investigations on how did you prepare for January 6th? And then what was the role of what happened on January 6th? And then, of course, how are you holding people accountable? And we've had one briefing with the FBI at the last briefing that had roughly arrested 200 people, and they were looking at they're looking at hundreds more, and people are responding. But I think we need to give them time to give us the documents, give us time to look over them, and see where we go to understanding what are the recommendations, obviously, to make sure this does not happen again. It was searing to most Americans and shocking beyond belief that the tradition of the peaceful transfer of power was violated that day. It was, it'll go down in history as one of the darkest, if not the darkest day, one of the darkest days in American history.
Congresswoman Carolyn,
I've also initiated this other investigation is with police chiefs across the nation, because there have been reports, and I believe 12 police off-duty police officers who participated in January 6th. And this is calling for these departments to really screen everyone who is working with them. If you are taking an oath to uphold the law and protect people, you certainly should not be part of a riotous mob that is breaking every law in the country and really going to the most sacred place in our country with great disrespect and with intent to destroy the leadership and to destroy the government. And they did for a while. They held us up several hours. We were constitutionally required to swear and to vote, debate and vote and support the votes of the Electoral College, which is what we did.
Wow.
And as soon as law and order was restored, we went back to work, and we worked through the night till 4 o'clock to vote for the certification of President Biden.
And that right there, I think, is an important point. Congresswoman Carolyn Maloney, Democrat from New York's 12th Congressional District, just about that this did have an effect on the ability of the United States Congress to hold a vote in the most basic form, a vote certifying the electoral count of a presidential election. It doesn't get more serious than that. Congresswoman Maloney, I know you've got to go. I want to thank you so much for being so generous with your time. Come back on, please, and talk to us about that investigation once you wrap that up.
We will.
All right, I appreciate it. All right, I know you have a busy day. Thank you, Congresswoman Maloney. Just to reset here, I'm Kevin Cirilli, Chief Washington Correspondent for Bloomberg Television and for Bloomberg Radio, accompanied by my colleagues, Jeannie Sean Zeno and Rick Davis. Rick, I mean, I thought that was a really interesting point that she made just about the investigation. And when you put it in simple terms with regards to what happened on January 6th, they were unable to conduct the business of the United States Congress. I mean, it's I think as this gets, you know, investigated and told, it really fundamentally stopped the ability of the United States government to do its work.
Yeah, it's a real real life experience in civics. These are dates set in the Constitution that the Electoral College will meet and vote on this day. And the idea that a mob tried to violate the terms of our Constitution set in stone, these dates are sacrosanct in our elections. There are a lot of things in elections that you can get away with, kind of push this, push that, but this is in the Constitution. And so when you violate the Constitution, you're taking a riot into a next level, and you do it in a joint session of Congress that's mandated by what our founders said is the best way for our democracy to operate. I think sometimes people think, wow, you know, that was too bad, because the Congress did a great job of reassembling and getting their job done. But the idea that anybody would condone a disruption of this nature, nevertheless, people in powerful positions, is really a question that I think people like Congresswoman Maloney and others will be not only investigating, but taking action. We have not heard the end of this story when it comes to who was involved in this process in the Congress, and did they violate their oath to the Constitution in supporting this activity?
All right. I want to talk about just in the final few minutes that we have on this show before I go on my 2-week vacation, but I will be back. I'll be back. And Rick and Jeannie are going to hold down the fort for me while I'm away. But Jeannie, I want to start with you just in terms of the geopolitics. And I'm thinking of how the world would react to America's inauguration today. And there was a moment where President Biden spoke directly to the world, and it was brief. And he looked at the stage behind him, and he said to his Republicans and Democrats who were accompanying him in the, again, an audience of peers, and he said, I know that you understand this. I'm paraphrasing, but now I'll speak to the world. I'm putting myself in a global leader's, I'm not going to even go there, Kevin, rein it in. I'm thinking of how the world would view today's inauguration, Jeannie Zeno, and the images coming out of America over the past 2 weeks. And I just, what perspective as a professor do you think global leaders around the world thought of today and where democracy stands in America after what happened just more than a week ago?
It's such an important point, because one of the challenges that has come about as a result of the Trump administration's policies vis-a-vis the rest of the world has been this almost turning away from, or not almost, has been this turning away from our traditional allies, has been this, you know, America first, America great idea. And so what has happened is we have sort of gone it alone, and we have all seen what that has meant as you look at our important allies in NATO, for instance. And so my view is that for our allies, this was a moment of relief, sort of as you talked about at the beginning, a return to normalcy. And one thing we know is that Joe Biden is focused on reestablishing those important relationships, because he has a more traditional view in line with the establishment, to use a bad word, of the Democratic and Republican parties, which is that the United States cannot go it in the world alone. As you confront things like a nuclear Iran, potentially a resurgent China and Russia, these things require these multilateral relationships and this sort of post-World War II world, if you will. And we know that Biden is committed to reestablishing those. So I think for our allies in particular, it is something of a relief.
Yeah, what makes me really happy, Jeannie, is that our enemies are really having a bad night tonight. You know, I mean, 4 years ago, Vladimir Putin was throwing a party. Tonight, he's kicking the dog. Nothing makes me happier. Nothing makes me happier than to think we've spoiled his dessert, right? I mean, it's who we are as a country, right? We're competitive. We wanna have our brand of exceptionalism exported around the world, because we think that we're the greatest country for good in the world.
And we are.
And Joe Biden made that case today. And the one thing that our enemies around the world, those who want darkness, not light, have enjoyed for the last 4 years is Donald Trump's view that the world is not his problem, right? He's just going to leave it alone and focus on the U.S. And Joe Biden showed up on the world stage today. He's taken action in his first few hours as president to create some of that leadership. And boy, we have spoiled a lot of despots night tonight.
All right. Highlights in the last 2 minutes that I have left. Highlights from today's inaugural ceremonies. Rick, I'm going to start with you.
Amanda Gorman.
Yes.
The inaugural poet, stole my heart.
Yeah.
Most emotional component of the entire inauguration.
Thank you for bringing her up, because she really was remarkable. Yeah, I couldn't agree more. Okay, Jeannie, the highlight of the inauguration for you today.
She was amazing. I thought Garth Brooks did a stunning job today. Yeah. I was very riveted to his performance.
Yeah, and you know, leave it to W to remind him about the hat. Am I right or am I right? I mean, the poor guy forgot the hat, I thought. You just think of all the pressure. He didn't even have any instruments. He just took the mic and started singing. You know, I watched back, and I truly cannot say just how amazing that national anthem was. The correspondent next to me was brought to tears. I mean, the way that played in the room and or outdoors in that area, it was remarkable. And when I watched how it played on television after, when she sang... and the flag was still there, she actually turned almost adjacent to the flag at the top of the Capitol and pointed at it. And it felt like the lyric connected to the moment as a result of the attack on the Capitol. And it was, I literally had goosebumps, because that's where the attack was. Where the inauguration was where they rushed. And so to hear, but the flag was still there, and to participate, to get to witness to history, the inauguration, I am incredibly grateful to have been able to participate and witness this uniquely American moment and an historic American tradition. I'll be back in 2 weeks. I'm not going anywhere. I'm the chief Washington correspondent for Bloomberg Television and for Bloomberg Radio. This is Bloomberg.